Section 6. Misconceptions about women issues. Now come to the first of these, and that is, women are less sensible than men. The following hadith is generally presented to support the view that women are less sensible than men. Abu Sayyid al-Khudri narrated, once the Prophet set off for the prayer place on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr or Eid al-Azha. He passed by a group of women and said, and I've seen no one more than you rob even a resolute man of his senses, in spite of being naqisat al-aql wa-deen. They said, O Allah's Messenger, what is this naqs in our religious and worldly affairs? He said, is not the evidence of a woman equal to one half of a man's? They said, yes. He said, this is the naqs in their worldly affairs. He said, is it not a fact that when they enter the period of menses, they neither pray nor fast? They said, yes. Whereupon the Prophet said, this is the naqs in their religious affairs. Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami' al-Sahih, Volume 1, page 116, Hadith number 298. This misconception has arisen because of a wrong translation of the Arabic phrase naqisat al-aql wa-deen. The word naqs has generally been translated as defective, keeping in view the Urdu meaning of the word. However, in Arabic, the verb naqasa means to reduce, and the word aql here means worldly affairs, since it is used in conjugation with the word deen, or religion. Keeping in view both these aspects, the correct translation of the above phrase, if the context is also taken into consideration, is that women have been given a relief and reduction in their worldly and religious affairs. The relief in worldly responsibilities, as is mentioned in this hadith, is that women have not been dragged in certain activities in affairs. For example, the Quran urges men to testify on legal documents so that women are relieved of appearing in courts and wasting their precious times on affairs which others can handle. Only if men are not available should a society involve women in such affairs. The relief women have been given in religious affairs is that they are not required to pray or fast during their monthly periods, as is mentioned in this hadith. So what must be kept in mind is the fact that the meaning of a word does not always remain the same in two different languages. For example, the word ghaliz in Arabic means firm, while in Urdu it means dirty. Thus the Quran has referred to marriage as mithaq and ghaliza, a firm agreement. Moreover, people who think that women are less sensible than men on the basis of this hadith do not realize that the hadith is not merely saying that women are naqisati aql. It is also saying that they are naqisati deen. If naqisati aql means that there is some defect in their aql or intellect, then by the same token, naqisati deen should mean that there is also some shortcoming in the religion they follow. This, of course, is absurd, and as referred to above, is the result of keeping the Urdu meaning of the word in consideration. We now come to the second misconception, and that is, Islam permits men to keep slave women. Among many other misconceptions about Islam is the notion that it gives sanction to slavery and permits its followers to enslave prisoners of war, particularly women, and establish extramarital relations with them. The fact is that Islam has not the slightest link with slavery and concubinage. On the contrary, it completely forbids these practices. It is quite outrageous to associate such an atrocious thing with a religion revealed to upgrade humanity. The point which needs to be appreciated, and which perhaps is the real cause of the misconception, is that Islam had adopted a gradual process to abolish the institution of slavery because of the social conditions prevalent in Arabia at that time. It must be kept in mind that slavery was an integral part of the pre-Islamic Arab society. There were scores of slave men and women in almost every house. This was largely due to two reasons. Firstly, during those times, the standard practice of dispensing with prisoners of war was to distribute them as slaves among the army which captured them. Secondly, there were extensive slave markets in Arabia in that period where men and women of all ages would be sold like commodities. In these circumstances, in which slavery had become an essential constituent of the Arab society, Islam adopted a gradual way to eliminate it. An immediate order of prohibition would have created immense social and economic problems. It would have become impossible for the society to cater for the needs of a large army of slaves who were otherwise dependent on various families. Also, the national treasury was in no position to provide them all on a permanent basis. A large number among them were old and incapable of supporting themselves. The only alternative left for them, if they were instantly freed, would have been to turn to beggary and become an economic burden on the society. The question of slave girls and women was even more critical, keeping in view their own low moral standards. Freeing them all of a sudden would have only resulted in a tremendous increase in brothels. Perhaps the reason behind this gradual eradication can be understood better if one considers the position which interest occupies in the economy of many Muslim countries today. No one can refute that the economies of these countries are interest-ridden. How the parasite of interest has crippled their national economies is apparent to every keen eye. However, there is no denying the fact that without it, their economic system cannot sustain themselves. Every reasonable person will acknowledge that today, if a government wishes to rid the economy of this menace, then, in spite of its utter prohibition in Islam, it will have to adopt a gradual methodology. During this interim period, interest-based deals will have to be tolerated and temporary laws will have to be enacted to handle them. Just as the Quran had given certain provisional directives about slaves during the interim period of their gradual eradication, an alternative economic framework will have to be steadily incorporated in place of the existing one. A sudden abolition without any parallel basis will only hasten the total collapse of the economic system, which, of course, would be disastrous for that country. To avert a similar disaster and to ward off a similar catastrophe, 1400 years ago, Islam had adopted a progressive and a gradual scheme to do away with the inhuman institution of slavery. Various directives are presented at various stages, because of which it gradually became possible for this evil to be eradicated from the society. These measures are summarized below and form a translation from the relevant parts of Javed Ahmed Ghamidi's Mizan. 1. In the very beginning of its revelation, the Quran regarded emancipation of slaves as a great virtue and urged people in a very effective way to do so. The tremendous appeal found in the words it adopted, Fakku Rakaba, release of necks, can be well imagined by a person who has flair for the language. It is evident from the context of such expressions, wherever they are found in the Quran, that it has regarded this virtue to be the first as well as the greatest step in pleasing God. In a similar manner, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam also urged Muslims to liberate humanity from the yoke of slavery in the following words: whoever liberated a Muslim slave, the Almighty in return for every limb of that slave would shield every limb of that person from hell. Muslim, Al-Jami'a Sahih, Volume 2, page 1147, Hadith number 1509. 2. People were urged that until they free their slaves, they should treat them with kindness. The way their masters had total and unchecked control in them in the age of ignorance was put to an end. They were told that slaves are human beings too, and no one should in any way violate the rights they possess as human beings. Abu Huraira r.a. narrated from the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, a slave has a right to food and clothing, and he shall not be asked to carry out an errand that is beyond him. Muslim, Al-Jami'a Sahih, Volume 3, page 1284, Hadith number 1662. Abu Dharr Ghifari, Azza Ta'ala Anhu, narrates from the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wasallam, they are your brothers. The Almighty has made them subservient to you. So whatever you eat, feed them with it. Whatever you wear, clothe them with it, and never ask them to do something which is beyond them. And if there is such a task, then help them out with it. Muslim, Al-Jami'a Sahih, Volume 3, page 1282, Hadith number 1661. Ibn Umar r.a. narrates from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, whoever slapped a slave or beat him up would atone this sin by liberating him. Muslim, Al-Jami'a Sahih, Volume 3, page 1657, hadith number 1279. Abu Masood radiallahu anhu says, "Once when I was beating my slave, I heard a voice from behind me, 'O Abu Masood, you should know that the Almighty has more power over you.' When I turned back, I found that it was Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I immediately remarked, 'O Messenger of God, I liberate him for the sake of God.' The Prophet said, 'Had you not done this, you would have been given the punishment of the fire.'" Muslim, Al-Jami' al-Sahih, Volume 3, page 1659, hadith number 1281. Ibn Umar رضي الله عنه narrates that once a person came to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and asked, "How many times should we forgive our servant?" At this, the Prophet kept quiet. He asked again, and the Prophet again kept silent. Upon being asked the third time, the Prophet answered, 70 times a day." Abu Dawud, Sunan, Volume 4, page 341, hadith number 5164. 3. In cases of unintentional murder, zihar, and other similar offenses, liberating a slave was regarded as their atonement and sadaqah. 4. It was directed to marry off slave men and slave women who were capable of marriage so that they could become equivalent in status, both morally and socially, to other members of the society. 5. If a person were to marry a slave woman of someone, great care was exercised, since this could result in a clash between ownership and conjugal rights. However, such people were told that if they did not have the means to marry free women, they could marry, with the permission of their masters, slave women who were Muslims and were also kept chaste. In such marriages, they must pay their dowers so that this could bring them gradually equal in status to free women. The Quran says, وَمَنْ لَمْ يَسْتَطِعْ مِنْكُمْ طَوْلًا أَنْ يَنْكِحَ الْمُحْسَنَاتِ الْمُؤْمِنَاتِ فَمِمَّا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُكُمْ مِنْ فَتَيَاتِكُمُ الْمُؤْمِنَاتِ وَاللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِإِيمَانِكُمْ بَعْضُكُمْ مِنْ بَعْضٍ فَانْكِحُوهُنَّ بِإِذْنِ أَهْلِهِنَّ وَآتُوهُنَّ أُجُورَهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ مُحْسَنَاتٍ غَيْرَ مُسَافِحَاتٍ وَلَا مُتَّخِذَاتِ أَخْدَانٍ ذَلِكَ لِمَنْ خَشِيَ الْعَنَتَ مِنْكُمْ وَأَنْ تَصْبِرُوا خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. And if any one of you does not have the means wherewith to wed free believing women, he may wed believing girls from among those whom you own. And God has full knowledge about your faith. You are from one another, so wed them with the permission of their owners and give them their dowers according to the norms. The only condition is that they should be kept chaste, neither being lustful nor taking paramours. This permission is for those among you who fear sin. But it is better for you that you practice self-restraint. And God is ever-forgiving, most merciful. Surah number 4, verse 25. 6. In the heads of zakah, a specific head, fir riqab, or for freeing necks, was instituted so that the campaign of slave emancipation could receive impetus from the public treasury. 7. Fornication was regarded as an offense, as a result of which prostitution centers that were operated by people on the basis of their slave women were shut down automatically, and if someone tried to go on secretly running this business, he was given exemplary punishment. 8. People were told that they were all slaves of God, and so instead of using the word abd and amma, which means slave man and slave woman respectively, the words used were fata and fatat, which means man and woman, so that the psyche about them should change, and a change is also brought about in age-old concepts. 9. A big source of the institution of slavery at the advent of the last prophet was the prisoners of war. When such a situation arose for the Muslims, the Quran emphasized that they cannot be kept as slaves and must be kept as prisoners of war. After this, if they were to be released, then there were two possibilities. They could be freed either by accepting ransom or as a favor by not taking any ransom money. No other option was available to the Muslims. 10. Finally, the following directive was given. وَالَّذِينَ يَبْتَغُونَ الْكِتَابَ مِمَّا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُكُمْ فَكَاتِبُوهُمْ إِنْ عَلِمْتُمْ فِيهِمْ خَيْرًا وَآتُوهُمْ مِمَّا لِلَّهِ الَّذِي آتَاكُمْ. And if any of your slaves asks for mukatabat, give it to them if you know any good in them, and for this give them out of the wealth which God has given to you. Surah number 24, verse 33. The above quoted verse of Surah An-Nur mentions the director of a mukhatabat. It is a term which means that a slave make a contract with his master, according to which he would be required to pay a certain sum of money in a specific time period, or would carry out a specific service for his master. Once he successfully fulfills either of these two options, he would stand liberated. In the above quoted verses, the Almighty has directed the Muslims to necessarily accept this contract made by a slave if he wants to make it, and has the required ability to become financially independent. It is further stated that a Muslim government should spend money from the public treasury, which here is called the treasury of God, in helping such slaves. It is evident from the words of the verse that just as this right of mukhatabat was granted to slave men, it was also granted to slave women. This, in other words, was in fact a declaration that slaves could now be masters of their destiny and could liberate themselves whenever they wanted. We now come to the third misconception, and that is, women must travel with a mahram. Most scholars are of the opinion that women cannot travel alone. They must be accompanied by a mahram who is a relative with whom marriage is prohibited. Therefore, in journeys such as Hajj, they do not allow women to travel alone. The following ahadiths are the basis of their view. Abu Huraira narrates that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "It is not permissible for a woman who believes in God and the last day to travel a distance for one day and one night without a mahram with her." Muslim Al-Jami' As-Sahih, Volume 2, page 977, Hadith number 1339. Abu Sa'id Al-Khudri narrates that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "A woman has been stopped from traveling a distance for 2 days except with her husband or mahram with her." Muslim Al-Jami' As-Sahih, Volume 2, page 976, Hadith number 827. It needs to be appreciated that there are a number of ahadith in which directives have been given by the Prophet for the well-being of the Muslims. However, if the circumstances in which such directives have been given change, then, as is the case with all conditional directives, such directives may no longer apply in the changed circumstances. The directives given to Muslim women about traveling belong to the above-mentioned category. To ensure a safe journey for a woman and to protect her moral character from any scandalous allegation in the strife-ridden society of Arabia, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam bade them travel with a mahram relative. Thus, all tours and journeys, etc., in which the above two bases still exist, the condition of a woman traveling with a mahram must be followed. However, with the changed circumstances of modern times, traveling has become a lot different from what it used to be in previous days. There are some travels in which safety, both physical as well as moral, is ensured. So, in such cases, the mahram condition no longer applies. As far as the decision as to which journeys have become safe is concerned, the traveler must decide for herself. We now come to the fourth misconception, and that is, women will outnumber men in hell. The following hadith is often presented to support the view that women will outnumber men in hell. Abu Sa'id al-Khudri reported, "God's Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam went out to the place of prayer on the day of Eid al-Adha or Fitr. So he passed by a group of women and said to them, 'O women, give charity, for I have been shown the majority amongst you as the inmates of hell.' They said, 'God's Messenger, wherefore?' The Prophet replied, 'It is because you curse one another very much and show ungratefulness to your husbands.'" Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami' As-Sahih, Volume 1, page 116, Hadith number 298. This inference is incorrect and has arisen by not properly appreciating a particular style of communication used in certain ahadith which depict dreams of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Such dreams are a source of revelation for the prophets of God, and in them they are shown certain images by the Almighty for the purpose of educating the believers. As a principle, all such dreams are not to be interpreted literally. They contain realities which are depicted in symbolic form. Symbolic representation is a very subtle and powerful way of expression. Facts seem veiled, yet for him who pauses to ponder, they are the most evident. They move a person in the manner poetry does. They ignite in a person the spark to look behind the apparent. They urge him to reflect and to meditate and then to discover and to infer. They educate him without rousing his prejudices. The prophets of God have effectively employed this technique of communication. The words and discourses of the prophets Joseph and Jesus, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, for example, are full of powerful parables and subtle symbolism. The dream of the prophet Joseph, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the way he interpreted it is mentioned in the Quran also. If he saw in his dream that the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down before him in prostration, he knew that these heavenly bodies symbolized certain personalities. The ahadith which depict more women in hell should also be interpreted keeping in view this basic principle. These ahadith do not delineate the population of women in hell, since this would be a literal interpretation. On the contrary, they just caution them that there are certain deeds which they do a lot and which therefore could be more instrumental in taking them to hell. So they should avoid them. In other words, the symbolism is causative in nature. In the above-quoted hadith, the cause has been symbolized to warn women of something which they often do. We now come to the fifth misconception, and that is, women are inferior to men. It is argued by some people that men are superior to women. They present the following verses in support of their view. الرِّجَالُ قَوَّامُونَ عَلَى النِّسَاءِ بِمَا فَضَّلَ اللَّهُ بَعْضَهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ وَبِمَا أَنفَقُوا مِنْ أَمْوَالِهِمْ. Men are the guardians of women because God has given the one more preference over the other and because they support them. Surah number 4, verse 34. وَلِلْرِجَالِ عَلَيْهِنَّ دَرَجَةٌ. And the husbands have a degree of superiority over them. Surah number 2, verse 228. It needs to be appreciated that as per the Quran, men and women as human beings are equal and deserve equal respect. However, they have been entrusted with different responsibilities in a family setup which make them superior to one another in various respects. According to the Quran, as far as a husband is concerned, one sphere of his superiority is his status as the head of the family, alluded to in the verse, "Husbands are one degree superior to their wives," quoted earlier. There are certain spheres in which women by nature, physical, physiological, as well as psychological, are superior to men and much more suitable to do certain tasks. The 34th verse of Surah Nisa quoted earlier speaks of the relative superiority of a husband to his wife, that too in responsibility and status in just one sphere and cannot be generalized to men and women. Two reasons are given for granting the husband this status. Firstly, because generally they are physically and temperamentally more suited to this task, and secondly, because they have been entrusted with the responsibility of earning for the family. It also needs to be appreciated in this regard that Islam does not forbid women to earn a living. It has only relieved them of the responsibility of earning, which lies upon their husbands. It also needs to be understood that the verse does not say that the one among the husband or wife who supports the family should become the head. Husbands, whether their wives earn or not, are liable for this responsibility. A woman may earn if she likes or if some need arises, but since she has not been entrusted with this duty, she has not been given the governing position in the family. Here it should be appropriate to analyze another concept which has contributed to the notion that men are superior to women. As per a hadith, a woman is created from the rib of man, referring to the fact that Eve was created from Adam's rib and thus was a secondary being. The text of the hadith is, Abu Hurairah reports that Allah's Prophet said, "Treat women nicely, for a woman is created from a rib, and the most curved portion of the rib is its upper portion. So if you should try to straighten it, it will break. But if you leave it as it is, it will remain crooked. So treat them nicely." Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami'a Sahih, Volume 3, page 1212, Hadith number 3153. It needs to be appreciated that according to the Quran, Eve was not created from Adam's rib. The first verse of Surah Nisa explicitly states that the first man and woman, Adam and Eve, were created directly by the Almighty. The Quran states, يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ اتَّقُوا رَبَّكُمُ الَّذِي خَلَقَكُم مِّن نَّفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ وَخَلَقَ مِنْهَا زَوْجَهَا وَبَثَّ مِنْهُمَا رِجَالًا كَثِيرًا وَنِسَاءً وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ الَّذِي تَسَاءَلُونَ بِهِ وَالْأَرْحَامَ إِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ عَلَيْكُمْ رَقِيبًا. Mankind, fear Lord, who created you from a single person and created of like species his mate, and from these two scattered countless men and women in this world, and fear God through whom you seek mutual help, and fear breaking blood relationships. Indeed, God is watching over you. Surah number 4, verse 1. Some people translate this verse as, it is he who has created you from a single person, that is Adam, and then he created from him his wife, that is Eve. They explain this verse by saying that Eve was created from the rib of Adam. This misleading translation has probably arisen because of a literal translation of the Arabic words khalaqa minha zawjaha, which mean, if translated literally, created from it his wife. Actually, the word minha, or from a soul, does not imply that Eve was made from Adam. It rather implies that Eve was made from the same species as Adam. A similar verse points to this interpretation. وَاللَّهُ جَعَلَ لَكُم مِّنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا. And it is God who has made from your species your mates. Surah number 16, verse 72. A literal translation of the words جَعَلَ لَكُم مِّنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا of the above quoted verse, which are similar to وَخَلَقَ مِنْهَا زَوْجَهَا, would mean, it is God who has created your mates from you, implying that every wife is made from her husband as Eve was. This, of course, is incorrect. The word anfus, which is the plural of nafs in this verse, means genre or species and not physical being. As far as the actual hadith quoted above is concerned, it needs to be appreciated that in Arabic, the words created form do not necessarily refer to the substance of creation. They can also refer to the nature of something. For example, the Quran says, man has been created from hastiness. Surah number 21, verse 37. This does not, of course, mean that man's substance is hastiness. It only refers to his nature. Secondly, if all the textual variants of this hadith are collected and analyzed, it becomes evident that the Prophet has compared the nature of a woman with a rib. The comparison subtly alludes to the fact that a woman's nature is very delicate and tender, as well as a bit adamant. The Prophet Muhammad has advised men to treat them tactfully, keeping in view this nature. Instead of forcing them to accept a particular point of view, men should always try to convince and persuade them.